The unique quality of the God of the Hebrew Bible and of our faith through Jesus Christ is that this God does not reign in some heavenly realm unsullied by the experiences of this world, but this is a God known by us through God's involvement in the actual pains and sorrows, joys and victories of humans. This then means that if we are going to understand our life in relationship to God, we're going to have to understand God as involved in all of the experiences of humans, and that includes conflict. So that's where we put it. We went on to suggest that in terms of method, we can't understand the Bible as a recipe book giving us solutions to specific problems today. The proof texting method is not adequate. Rather, we have to understand the Bible as a collection of responses of the faithful community to God's initiating activity, God's involvement, creatively and redemptively on behalf of humans. The community of faith recognized God's involvement, imperfectly to be sure, and they responded with hymns, with history writings, with accounts. This is what gathered and collected into what has become our Bible. The Bible, therefore, is not a collection of timeless truths, but it is the testimony of God's people and what it describes as a relationship. A relationship, we suggested, is ongoing. It's dynamic. What we find in the Bible, then, is how faithful people live in relationship to God. We don't get specific answers. We get a perspective, a model of how people of faith live. And, of course, we get major principles with regard to what is God's nature, that is to say, what we are to imitate as God's people. Now we get into the fun. We get into the texts themselves. Yesterday was really preparation. And I suggested that when it comes to evaluating the texts of the Bible themselves, it's not terribly useful to set up as the major categories war and peace. If you do that, and you want some sort of criteriology here to try to evaluate war in the Bible in preparation for evaluating war today, if you have just those categories, war and peace, the tendency will be to say war, bad, peace, good. But how about that kind of peace that the false prophets commend? Peace at all costs. The kind that Hananiah, in opposition to Jeremiah, commended. God won't allow any harm to God's people. Jeremiah said, that's not peace. You know, the prophets come and said, woe to those of you who say peace, peace, where there is no peace. Those categories aren't adequate, in my mind. Much more biblical and much more basic to biblical experience is the contrast between chaos and shalom. Chaos as all that which is hostile to life, that which divides, that which creates gaps between different human beings and community, ultimately that which destroys both communal life and individual life and the life of nature. Shalom is much more than peace. Shalom is harmony, cosmic well-being, equality. It is all that which engenders and fosters life for all living beings. It's God's order. That's the contrast that's essential to biblical experience. Now, I would like to see whether, as we move to the Bible with this criterion, contrast between chaos and shalom, we would be able to fill out the definition. What do you associate, first of all, with chaos? What is the ungodly family that constitutes chaos?
Lack of order.
Lack of order. So disorder, we might say, okay? Others?
Violence.
Violence.
Hatred.
Hatred.
Bigotry.
Bigotry.
Oppression.
Oppression. prejudice, bigotry, prejudice. I'm going to allow those two to, although they are nuances of difference.
Destruction.
Okay.
Slavery.
Alienation.
Injustice.
It's a very complete picture. Yeah, I heard another.
Bias.
Okay. We could go on, but we begin to see a picture here of void, of negativity, of all of that which causes life to collapse. Just picture living with these swirling dark clouds around you, and you can really begin to picture what that sort of life is like. And no one mentioned that word. I guess because I had sort of expurgated or something. But what's the word?
War.
There it is. And you mentioned another one.
Sin.
Absolutely. Very basic down here. As that which is that ungodly sickness at the center. But now it's very interesting, and I think of deep insight on your part, that war is not the chief issue here. It's all of this stuff that finally creates a climate where people can only start fighting with each other. I would say, inevitable. And the major point that you made by that, I wasn't expecting that. I thought war was going to come out much sooner, but you made a major point there, that the problem of war is very, very complex and deep. When you finally have war, you're at a very late stage of the sickness. Now, how about shalom?
Before we go there, could we call it hell?
You bet. Yeah, hell is, that's right. And you know, some people have defined hell as absence of God. Mm-hmm. So you could say hell, absence of God. God doesn't reign here. That's why all of this has fallen apart. God is not acknowledged as sovereign. All kinds of other idols are there. You know, these are idols. You could put greed, to try to fill in the positive ingredients of this. You know, what are people worshiping? Greed, materialism, individualism, success,
lust.
What else?
Selfishness.
Those are the gods reigning there, and these are the products, the results of that reign. Godlessness, hell, absence of God's presence. That's what that realm is. Now, already we've said that over here God reigns. By implication. Now by affirmation, God reigns. Now, what are the products of that realm where God's sovereignty is acknowledged as the only loyalty? The only supreme loyalty. Love.
Love, joy. Reconciliation. Forgiveness.
Hold it. I can't write. Try again. Uh-oh. Why do they just give off so suddenly? Was I holding upside down? Well, we may just have to live with this one in our hearts. Better place for it anyway. Pardon me? Okay. Let's just hear them. Love.
Is there a cap? A cap will help rejuvenate it, perhaps.
You put the cap on while I'm resting?
Well.
Okay. Peace.
Unity.
Sharing.
Forgiveness.
Reconciliation.
Peace
has been mentioned. That came out sooner than the war did on the other side, thank goodness. Hey?
Justice.
Very important when we think now communally. Yeah.
Would you put compromise over there?
Reconciliation may be a way to avoid the suggestion that whenever you have a dispute, you find middle ground. I don't find that justice survives in a climate like that very well. I think there are principles where, and of course this will have direct bearing, I'm glad you mentioned that, because it'll have direct bearing on this problem of war. If war were the this end of the, you know, were the absolute bad, the absolute evil, then compromise would be an absolute good, because you would avoid war at all costs. And so if you have a difference between two opposing sides, then the methodology that you would invoke would be that of compromise. I'm not sure that with this contrast, compromise is elevated to a principle. But that'll be something we're going to discuss, because I suspect that some people will be pacifists in this group. And that question may reemerge, whether in fact war is an unmitigated evil. I'm going to argue that there is a place for war. Ecclesiastes said that. That's not my reason for affirming that. But I'm saying that with this contrast, there is an argument for war in certain very, very, very extreme and limited cases. Not for nuclear war, though, because I think that is squarely there. We're going to talk about that this afternoon. I'm changing the sessions. We're going to have one on Judaism and Christianity so as to have one extra session for war and peace. Okay, now here we have two realms. That's very biblical. These days, people tend not to speak in terms of absolutes, good and evil, life and death, but grays. You know, everything's in between. That's not biblical. The Bible says you've got to choose between life and death, between chaos and shalom. Now we're going to go through some biblical history. And this I find most fun of all, because here we really get into the material. Turn to Exodus 15. We're going to look at cases of war in the Bible. This battle we're going to deal with is the conflict at the sea. And I'm wondering if someone would read Exodus 15, the first three verses, and someone else would read Exodus 15, verses 9 through 11. Let's see two hands. Who will read 1 through 3? Excellent. And there's 9 through 11. Now, this is going to be a battle, a depiction of a battle. And I want you already to start asking, is this chaos? Is this serving chaos or shalom?
Then Moses and the people of Israel sang this song to the Lord, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and my song, and he has become my salvation. This is my God, and I will praise him, my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name.
The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil, my desire shall have its fill of them. I will draw my sword, my hand shall destroy them. Thou didst blow with thy wind, the sea covered them, they sank as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, terrible in glorious deeds, doing wonders?
Thank you. So there we have now a picture of conflict. I can't teach without something to write with, so Bob's going to go and find one. Now, what I need to do, yesterday we realized that it's just meaningless to interpret the Bible out of context. So here we have a text that's growing out of a specific situation. We can't evaluate or understand that text until we first of all see its meaning within its own context. We've got to know that context, its historical setting, and what it was doing there. Okay, so its setting. This was sung, we hear, by Miriam, a little later on by Miriam and a group of women. They're shouting to God, thanking God for deliverance. Deliverance from what? Israel, of course, was, at least some of the Israelites, Hebrews, were enslaved in Egypt. That's a very specific setting. We know from extra-biblical sources a lot about Egypt at that time. When I get chalk, I'll draw it for you. But basically what we know is that this was a very, very old and stable society. It was a specific type of community. Principle in this community was the deity of the king. It's a hierarchical, it's a well-stratified structure where every class of people has its place. The king is king forever, he is God, the slave is a slave forever, and there is no possibility of movement or change. That's the nature of society in that world. All right, we're really back into writing here. So we're going to draw Egypt of the Hebrew experience as a pyramid. Here's Horus, the god. And that god is incarnate in the Pharaoh. The Pharaoh, in turn, has around him the vizier and lords. And there are the priests. And then there's the nobility. And then there are the landowners. Nomarchs are called. And then there are the serfs. There are the native slaves, those that have fallen into debt and into slavery. And finally, there are the foreign slaves. And among them, we have the Hebrews. Now, we know the village where a lot of these Hebrews lived, and we know the documents, we know what their life was like. It was secure. Every day they knew what was expected of them. They had their bread. And above all, they knew that this was a land governed by Horus and the divine king. However, we read in the Bible that this was a group that somehow could not just be satisfied with that the way the other slaves were. They were aware of a quality of life that this system denied, namely freedom. That security was not the most desirable quality of life. Freedom. Freedom to determine future, to be in control of one's own destiny as a people. And the patriarchal stories tell us how they knew that. There was a preliminary memory of a god under different names, not Yahweh, that came known only during this time, but El, in various forms of El, El Shaddai, that's the Canaanite god. But a god who was coming to them and promising them one day they would be a people, would be free, and would have a land. And it was that memory that enabled this particular group of slaves, unlike the others, to cry to heaven, but not to Horus. Horus's job was to guarantee the power of the king. They cried to heaven to this other god, nebulous, almost unknown. And that god heard. And that god did not operate socially to uphold the classes. That god did not operate with a trickle-down theory, so to speak, where each class got what was left over from the class above. That was a system of special privilege. This god acknowledged the equality of all beings, and where that equality was violated, this god intervened on behalf of those thus violated. And in this case, it meant that that people challenged the Pharaoh. Now, we know the plague stories. We know that there were preliminary negotiations, attempt to break free in a nonviolent way. But the Pharaoh's heart was hardened, we're told. He would not negotiate or compromise. And that led to the sea. Here they are finally out of the land. The Pharaoh tries to reimpose slavery upon them. There is an encounter, and there is a conflict. And we read about that conflict. It was bloody. There was bloodshed. There was death. In other words, the opposite side of the coin of freedom was loss of life, was defeat for one of the groups. Now, what do you think of that conflict? Yeah, Bob?
You need to keep the cap on there. Dry out.
What do we make of? Is this a subservient to chaos or shalom? This is a battle, right? And it's a violent one. You happy with that war in the Bible? That conflict, that battle? Or do you wish it weren't there?
Well, it establishes a basic principle that God frees.
Mm-hmm.
And that is above kings or anything else.
Okay. Now that's really helpful as a starting clue. We know how these people, these Hebrews, viewed the heavens. You know, that realm that was in control. We read about that in Deuteronomy 32, 8 to 9. When Elyon, you can look that up if you want, because you're not going to believe this in the Bible, so you probably better. Maybe I better look so I don't misquote it, or it won't be in the Bible, and you'll be right. Why does someone read this? Deuteronomy 32, 8 and 9. This is how Israel at this time of the Exodus viewed the divine realm. First one to find it reads it. There you go.
When the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, when he divided all mankind, he set up boundaries for the peoples according to the number of the sons of Israel. For the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted inheritance.
Okay, that's it. Now, what happens in heaven at that point? This is a typical scene from ancient Near Eastern religious faith. This is how the heavens look. We've got a divine council, and they're gathering to do their work. The gods run the cosmos and determine the destinies of the peoples. And in charge is Elyon. Who's Elyon? Is that Israel's God? Who are the other dramatis personae here? There is Elyon, who's doing the job of dividing the nations. And then there are the category, just an unnamed group called the sons of God. So the sons of Elyon. So there's a group of divine sons here. And the job is to divide up the nations. You've got just this mass of people. Now you want to order them into some kind of rational divisions. How do you divide the nations into the peoples into nations? On the basis of what?
Heritage?
Heritage? No.
Each god has a nation.
Each god has a nation. On the basis of how many gods are available. Okay. Oh. Isn't that something? So here you got Horus, and so you can have Egypt. Horus is one of the members of the divine assembly. Okay, there you get Egypt. You've got Baal. They're not all named here, but we know their names. And so you get Canaan, the people that lived in the land before Israel. You've got Hadad, so you can have Syria. And you've got Chemosh, so you got Moab. And you've got Dagon. So you got the Philistines, and you've got the one is named by name.
Most High.
Most High, Yahweh. There's one of the sons. Elyon is named, but that's the presiding God. One of these sons of God is Yahweh. Okay, good. So we can have Israel or Jacob. Those are parallel names for Israel. Did you know that's how the earliest Hebrews looked at the world? Elyon was the high god, and Yahweh was one of these lower gods. Now, what happens in the Exodus in their eyes is this. Here's a conflict between two of those gods, Yahweh and Horus. And when Yahweh fights Pharaoh, Pharaoh is the embodiment of Horus. Pharaoh is God, is Horus. And so what we have here is Yahweh fighting Horus and winning. Now, that happens all the time. You have the Babylonian god fighting the Assyrian god, and the god who wins is seen as superior in heaven, and you have a realignment of powers. In extreme cases, one of these gods can defeat the high god and become the high god. But the main thing is, each of these gods is a god of a nation. These are nation cults, nationalistic deities. They function only to preserve their nation. Okay, so on the surface of it, this Exodus could say, now Israel is superior to Egypt. We have a national God. His job now for the rest of the history of Israel is to serve Israel. But you already suggested there's more in the Exodus story than that. Yahweh already is being proven not just to be the supporter of a new royal dynasty. You said that Yahweh is functioning in a different way here, and what was it?
Freedom.
To free people. To take those who are left out of the royal system, slaves, the poor, the weak, the powerless.
Is this group of gods comparable to the gods of the Olympus?
It's very, very similar. So the Greeks inherited from the ancient Semitic peoples. Exactly. And they just, you know, they're all taking care of their little domains, yeah?
Are we so different?
We have our idols too, and our national gods, don't we? And I'm glad you see that. Because, you know, we can say that's old and primitive, but we've got our collection of national gods too, right? And again, ours, we'd like to assert We'd like it, this God that's on our coins to assert itself over all the gods of the other nations. That's how our God should serve us, right? We have idols too, yeah.
This is doing a little bit of speculation with that Deuteronomy text, but it sounds like in verse 8, when the Most High divided up the nations, that the various gods, well, set boundaries for the people. That sounds like it's talking about a piece of land for each god.
That's right.
But in verse 9, when it talks about Israel, the Lord's portion is his people, not a piece of territory. Is that reading too much into that?
He fixed the bounds of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God for the Lord's portion. This certainly is the language of Exodus 19. Israel is God's possession and a nation of priests and the like. And I can see what you're getting at, that this is a people that can't be defined primarily by a piece of real estate, but rather by being Yahweh's. I'm not sure whether that's in the thoughts of the original writers or not, but it's a good observation and worth further study, I would think. So Israel's relation would be more a spiritual one than a land-based one. That's possible. All the more possible because all of the other nation cults of that time were characterized by a temple, sacred space. Israel's relation was characterized by a relationship through covenant, which could also be preserved even when Israel wasn't in its land. Yeah, Jim.
Another question that I noticed in verse 8, it says, when the Most High gave the nations their inheritance, it doesn't say the gods their inheritance.
Yeah. He fixed the bounds according to the number of the sons of God. The Most High is the one here that's in charge of the division, obviously. And the gods are serving the Most High in maintaining those divisions. Their job is to serve their people, to be their patron God. Now, you could see how this very well could have just flown right directly into a nationalistic interpretation of Yahweh. Yahweh is just simply this genie who is to assure the fortunes, the good fortunes of Israel. However, this justice issue, that God did not immediately just set up a new king, but looked after the oppressed, is very clearly present in Israel's earliest thought on what it was to be as a nation. You find it in the earliest code of laws in Exodus 20 through 23, things like, if you lend to a person who is poor, do not exact interest and do not keep a garment in pledge. For if that person cries to me, I, God, will hear because I'm compassionate. There is an attention to the rights of every individual in this new country. Each family is to have a little portion of land. No one can own the land because God alone is king. If someone tries to steal or to confiscate or to buy land, God will not allow that. God will resist that. You can see that egalitarianism here, yes.
Were those rights in the new nation extended equally to males and females?
No, they weren't. Mm-hmm. Another illustration from the Book of the Covenant, chapter 21. In the seventh year you shall release the slave. Aha, it kind of pauses, the male slave. And then six verses later, but in the seventh year you shall not release the female slave. So the egalitarianism goes to a certain extent. Israel is certainly very much influenced by her world. We mention that, and this would apply to social practices like release of slaves or the question of whether you should have slaves at all, as much as it does to war. We said the Bible isn't static. Therefore, you can't use a proof text. If the Bible were static, my goodness, a law like that, according to the narrative given to God, to Moses on Sinai, must be the holiest of all laws. Well, it didn't remain binding. Deuteronomy was the next expression of the law. The same law is given, but the distinction is broken down. Male and female slave are released in the seventh year. And then you come to the final formulation of law in Deuteronomy, and law is forbidden. You are not allowed to have Hebrew slaves in Israel. You see how it grows with the growing experience of the people with their God in that covenant relationship. And the same with war. Israel's concepts of war will grow and develop. Now, war then, in Exodus 15, is changing function. In the ancient Near East, it served one king over another king. When one king won, you know, social structures didn't change. The only thing that changed was who's boss. But it was still an oppressive human. King. Now in Israel, you eliminate kings. And this war functions in a different way, to rectify the injustices of a king-dominated society. And that led inevitably to a redefinition of what society is. In Israel, it was to be a community of equals before God. And hence that echo throughout the Judges period, there is no king but Yahweh. Gideon says, I can't be your king. I did a good thing. You want me to be king? I will not be king, nor will my sons be king after me, for Yahweh is king. So that is a very different view of society, and in that society, war cannot serve kings. It may serve justice. Now, chaos or shalom. You suggested that there is a shalom factor, that this conflict has established a new type of society, a society in which these terrible, terrible qualities of chaos would be restrained by, I'm getting all kinds of good pens now, restrained by this spirit of God's reign that engenders justice, peace, compassion, all those other qualities that you mentioned. So I think that at the beginning one has to at least raise the question of whether that conflict did not serve shalom rather than chaos. Now, let's go on. We can't spend that much time, obviously, with many texts, so let me just mention the next one. Judges 5. We're into this new period now. The Hebrews are moving into the land. They're no sooner there than the Canaanite king, Sisera, attacks them. And I'd like us to read first person, Judges 5, verses 6 to 7. And I'll just narrate the rest, I think. Okay, now there are interesting phrases there. Do you see any hints as to the nature of the conflict between Sisera and Deborah's people? What's happened? What's happening? These people dedicated to a communal ideal of equality have something happening to their lifestyle.
Sounds like they're being driven back into the mountains.
That's right. That what's, if you're going to think in terms of that shalom chaos typology up here, what's happening?
Depression.
Exactly. That little orbit of shalom, that is to say equality and harmony, is being attacked by chaos, that which would reimpose stratification, would oppress, would reinstate the king as divine, special privileged. And so travelers can't travel. They can't bring their wares to market. The peasantry ceased. Peasants, these are free peasants, ceased because of an attack of a king. You see the social conflict between the two ideals? That's what's at stake here. Kings are trying to reimpose a feudalistic society on this group that insists that a different communal ideal is consistent with their understanding of God's sovereignty. And so there's a real threat to the heart of Israel. The rest of this story tells of the mustering of the tribes. There's no professional army here because there's no king to own an army or have taxation enough to support an army. It's just the peasants who grab their plows and grab their hoes. And you remember in our own history, the pictures of the Minutemen. That's what it is. It's a militia, and they go out to fight. There's going to be bloodshed. They're mustered. The tribes are mustered. They go out to fight. They go down, we're told. The direction is down. to the big fortified cities, to the gates, to the homes of the kings, and they fight. But that kind of fighting is hopeless because the Canaanites have chariots. And so finally it comes down to a different kind of battle. The king approaches the tent of Yael, a woman, a peasant, and she becomes God's instrument of victory. Comes in and she drives a stake through his skull. Now that ain't beautiful. There's nothing terribly on the surface but peaceful of that. But the question is, and I'm pressing hard, especially those of us who have pacifistic tendencies, was that a conflict, a bloody conflict, that manifested chaos or shalom? What do you think? Argue, take sides. Who thinks that it was an example of chaos, reassertion of violence and injustice and all those sordid qualities? How many think it was a manifestation of shalom? A reinstatement. Okay. But pretty wobbly. Someone senses problems, some ambiguity here. Remember what we said in the introductory lecture, those of you that were here. God, if God is going to be manifest in human experience, is going to be in some messy, ambiguous stuff. It ain't going to be easy oftentimes to discern where God is present. And so you're a little hesitant here. But the point is, there was a very, very threatening situation. If there had not been a mustering of the tribes, what would have happened to the little community of Shalom? Exterminated, reimposed upon it a feudalistic system of oppression and chaos. So I'm not going to solve it for us, but there it is. And probably that's the answer, that there is no final answer. But still, humans had to decide. One of the tribes didn't go. We're so, read here, cursed be, where is that? Meroz. Curse Meroz, says the angel of the Lord. Curse bitterly its inhabitants, because they came not to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. Was that the tribe that was a pacifist tribe? We can't fight. Well, according to this ideology, God curses them rather than say, well done, you're trying to maintain peace. Okay, now listen, these are not proof texts, right? That number one, so we can't prove against or for pacifism by reading that. Number two, second reason we can't use these as proof texts, is this is an early stage of an ongoing history. And so we can't set the early stage as definitive for all times. And thirdly, each of these texts address a particular situation, which is not our situation today. So there's plenty of room here for us to fudge if we feel uncomfortable with what the Bible is saying. Now, I saw a question, yes.
Yes, is this saying that we have the right to self-defense when we are in danger of being wiped out?
I think all it is saying is at some point, God's people felt that that was a godly response. And that's not enough for me yet to say that that is a principle binding on us. I'm going to have to see the rest of the history of war in the Bible to establish what you could call a trajectory, kind of the direction the Bible is pointing in. For example, I'm going to also have to factor in Jesus saying, turn the other cheek. But also that I have not come to bring peace in the world but a sword. Obviously, we're not going to solve this problem in three sessions. It's a terrible, terrible, vexing, hard problem what the Bible says to us today about war and peace. For the moment, I'm just throwing out biblical material and causing us to squirm. Was there another question?
Well, I'm not that much of a biblical scholar, so I don't know if this was before Moses.
This would be after Moses, yeah. This would be about 100 years after Moses.
But God had given the commandment to Moses, thou shalt not kill.
Yeah. Now that commandment, usually in its original setting, was regarded as having reference to fellow members of the Israelite community. Oh. Homicide.
Like, love your neighbor.
That's right.
Applies to Israelites only.
That's right. Yep. That had to grow too. And it probably originally stated, you shall not kill your neighbor. But it's significant that all those qualifiers were dropped off in the final form. There's a tendency in Israel to broaden the implication of commandments. even as there is a tendency to broaden the definition of Israel's mission in the world. It is not enough for you to be a light to the tribes of Israel, I mean, to raise up the tribes of Israel. You should be a light to the nations. And so we're in a process where God is tutoring a people, enlarging their vision. And certainly the commandments fall into that same process. Another instance. Okay, now we really come to the offensiveness, okay? We've got Joshua commanded to lead the people into Canaan and to kill everybody, to make room for this righteous nation. I'm not going to recount or read those stories. We started yesterday with a couple of them. But you remember, go there and kill everybody. Now that means men, women, babies, cattle. What do you make of those laws? Chaos or shalom? How many think shalom? Okay, someone's in a fighting mood. How many think chaos? Good, okay. Okay, well, you got all kinds of people. Doug, talk to that guy. Talk back to him. Tell him, first of all, you tell him why you think it's shalom, and you tell him why you think it's chaos.
They were commanded by God to carry out God's plan, and God's wisdom is certainly higher than human wisdom. They chose to obey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It seems to me that at the times, and I'm not a history scholar, of course, war and warring was the in thing, and it was natural that when you're taking over land and you have you are being called by your God to take over a land, and that you are the morally right people, that you assume the role of be converted or die, like with the Crusades. And so their interpretation of take over the land was take over the land and knock anything that's in your way out of it.
Okay, that's certainly the ideology. Now that ideology, by the way, I couldn't adjudicate, I couldn't say in this debate who won. Because again, the ambiguity of the situation. In that world, where we had this kind of setup, it was certainly the understanding of peoples that if you've got a God that's worthy of the name, that God is going to be able to protect you in battle. That's the major function of God. Now, these Israelites aren't coming tabula rasa off of the desert, uninfluenced by the cultural values and ideology of that time. They're steeped in it. Most of those who became Israel were peasants in Canaan and were converted to the Exodus story. You know, only a trickle of people came out of the Exodus. The later priestly writer had the whole nation coming, but it's been calculated that would have been an unbroken line of four abreast all the way from Egypt to Palestine if all those people had come. Now, that's a small group. Others heard the story, and they gathered around the Exodus story. And so, as they hear that story, they use the language of the time, and the language of the time says, if your God is effective, your God's going to be able to defeat the enemy. However, there's another little factor in here that should be remembered. Jim?
That sounds like the people who lived in the land were actually evangelized rather than exterminated.
Okay, a very different model, and you know some of the alt hypothesis and things like this. It seems this way to historians, that the picture of Blitzkrieg and total conquest and extermination of the inhabitants of Canaan is a later picture. It comes from the time of the kings, David, Solomon especially. Why? The book of Judges begins chapter 1 with another picture of conquest. It says that this tribe went into this area but was unable to conquer this city, that city, and it names all of the major Canaanite cities. The inhabitants of these cities were left in order that Yahweh could test the Israelites. We see a very different picture of conquest. Partial, tentative, these few Exodus people moving tentatively into Gilgal, telling their story. The Gibeonites come and say, look, it sounds credible. Can we confess with you and become followers of Yahweh? And the people of Shechem saying, we'd like to make a covenant with you. Slowly the story spreads.
Who are the ones who say they're going to confess with you?
The Gibeonites. Remember the story, they come to them in the book of Joshua, and they say, we've come afar. Look at our sandals. They're worn out and our bread is moldy. It's a ruse in order to be able to be accepted by these people. The story is attractive. It's alluring because these folks in Canaan, the peasants, the slaves, are experiencing the same oppression under their kinglets, their feudal lords, that the Israelites had experienced in Egypt. And so it's a social phenomenon. And it is a slow revolution, a peasant revolution. And it probably didn't involve any bloody kings in their cities being destroyed in that early period. It probably involved a skirmish here or there, but basically a very weak and vulnerable people getting a toehold. Now, archaeologically, we know that's corroborated. Can't prove it with archaeology, but Ai wasn't destroyed at that time. It was destroyed in 2200 BC, 1,000 years earlier. There's no evidence for a destruction of Jericho at that time. There were tells when the Israelites came of Ai and Jericho. And those broken walls, etc., allowed people during the times of the kings to answer their kids when they said, how in the heck did that city get so destroyed? And then it was that the story arose, when our people came in after the Exodus, God gave them these cities. And then they told the story. And it's hymnic rather than historical. It's not a newsreel. It's the people during the time of David when in fact these cities had been destroyed. It's a way of these people confessing God's glory. God was so strong that he gave us this rich land flowing with milk and honey. Now, that, however, doesn't exonerate the Bible from the story of the destruction of the Canaanites, does it? It just pushes it back a little bit into the period of Kings. And for that reason, I'd like to move on. Okay, kings are bad, right? And these early judges are good. Because kings conduct wars, and we've seen that the early folks there, you know, they're on this honeymoon with God, and they created this perfect community of shalom, and everyone's equal, and the welfare of the land is distributed justly, and oh, too bad, we got kings. Is that an adequate picture, contrast between the period of the judges and the kings? You suspect it, right? Because it's romantic, it's too perfect. Humans couldn't live in that kind of paradise. And if you look carefully at the book of Judges, you see that it's anything but idyllic. I believe in my heart that God gave humanity, the family of humans, through the Exodus, an alternative to oppression and war and injustice and hate. In fact, in the Mosaic period, a new concept of being human in community was born. But the earliest occupants of this new community blew it, left and right. And so Gideon has a father, this is one of our great judges and freedom fighters, has a dad who gives him a Baal name. And his dad builds an altar to Baal, the fertility god of the Canaanites. Well, that's a little evidence, but on the subject of war, what war do we find in the book of Judges? Well, it ends with a war. There was a certain Levite who had a concubine, and he went on this journey, and then he was traveling back, and he decided it was too far to travel on his ass all the way back home, so he had to stay in Benjaminite territory in the city of Gibeah. He was in the town square, and a man came back from his field and said, don't sleep there, come to my house, I'll give you hospitality. So he goes to that man's house, and he abides there, they have a glass of wine, their hearts are merry, and then some of the rogues of the city come and say, we want the Levite so we can have sex with him. And you know, with good Near Eastern hospitality, back to your question about equality now, the host says, oh no, that'd be a violation of hospitality, but here's his concubine and my virgin daughter, you can have them. Well, they take the concubine and they ravage her, they rape her, she dies during the night. Well, she manages to crawl up to the steps of the house. And so when the Levite is about to leave, he goes out and he finds his concubine there. He says, up on the ass, we're ready to go. She doesn't answer. He loads the ass with the corpse, takes her back to
Does
his country.
Does that mean necessarily that she was dead? You don't think he killed her when he chopped her in
pieces? I had never thought of that. That's even more gruesome. Could be. She was just comatose. And Barbara, what did he do with her?
He chopped her into 12 pieces, I think, and sent all the pieces all around the territory. And tried to get the people riled up against the men of that city, against the people of that city, and then they went and slew everyone in that city.
In the whole tribe of Benjamin.
Yeah, and then, but there were 400 men left who didn't have any wives then. So then they had to go ravage Shiloh to get wives for those men.
It's Jabesh-Gilead. They went,
yeah, Jabesh-Gilead, but there weren't enough there, and they needed 200
then
more,
they went
so
to
they
Shiloh.
Went to Shiloh and
right.
took the women who were out dancing.
Dancing, right. All right, now, it's to replenish the lost tribe of Benjamin. I mean, my gosh, what do you call that? How many say chaos? No question there. And, you know, it's this it's horrible, a picture of violence on all levels. You know, who's the guilty party there? People of Gibeah or the Benjaminites who then become victims? Or how about these poor people in Jabesh-Gilead, you know? They didn't respond to the muster. They're like Meroz. They didn't go and fight the Benjaminites. Maybe they're pacifists too. I think pacifists should look at some of these stories. They didn't go and fight. So then get my sides mixed up. Then all the tribes go up and they kill all of them, men, women, and children, except for the young virgin women, and take them and give them to the Benjaminites left, and there aren't enough, and so they take these innocent dancing daughters of Shiloh. I mean, my gosh, chaos. And the last, and that's after God gave Israel this wonderful opportunity. Last verse of Judges, someone read it. What's it say? How does it summarize this beautiful honeymoon period?
In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes.
Shalom or chaos?
Just every man did what was right in his own eyes.
Yeah, you'd rather say that, right? Sometimes it's better to keep the male biased language. Okay, well, we don't need to even, yeah.
Just one comment about the people of Meroz and Jabesh-Gilead being pacifists. I suspect there were no pacifists.
I don't think so either. Yeah, no, that's right. That solves that problem, Cynthia.
But why would the people have put that in the record of God's activity?
Yeah, that's a real interesting question. And I think it's one that bears back on Ernest Wright's attempt to see God as in a messy, messy situation when God related to an historical people.
That story about when the tribe of Benjamin nearly got wiped out, it doesn't really say that God commanded that war anymore.
No, it didn't.
That's good. They did it.
That's right. And by the way, though, cutting the living being into 12 pieces is what Gideon did. It's what you do when you call God's people to holy war.
Those were all animals. And David did it. No, Saul.
They were animals. Ox, yeah. An ox. These are very important details you're pointing out to get the nuance. Just back to Cynthia's question, though, just for a second. It's the same kind of thing that can be asked of why that Bathsheba affair. David is the pure king, you know, the forerunner of the Messiah, etc., etc. Why? Because these Israelites were just really darn honest when it came to telling their story. They didn't. Well, sometimes they did. The chronicler who retells Israel's history doesn't include the Bathsheba affair, nor anything else bad about David or Solomon. None of the wars, none of the bloodshed, none of the sin.
With one exception.
What's that?
He says that David was not allowed to build the temple because he had too much blood on
blood.
His hands.
But does that say, is that a reprimand? Well, it's saying that his function is not as priest. But I'm not sure that that's a reprimand. But I think you should enter a doctoral program at Harvard. Your Hebrew Bible knowledge is astonishing. Okay?
It seems to me that this is all a sinful human condition, and that God gave us free will, and men exercise it well or badly.
Yeah? So you give up on finding any evidence for God's purpose in the Bible?
No.
Is that your conclusion?
No, he knows. He has the overall picture, but he does allow us to do what we want to do, and then we take the consequences. And from evil, good arises.
Okay.
He has the long-term picture in his mind that we don't see.
Okay. Yes, all the way there.
What was the Hebrew concept of the forces of evil, or the demons, or whatever? Because I'm thinking, when God would talk to these leaders and say, go out and kill every woman and child, did they ever say in their mind, well, maybe this is an evil God rather than Yahweh speaking to me?
There certainly was that struggle. You see it in the prophets. where you have one prophet saying one thing and another, and so each of them has to figure out why is it that this person says, thus says the Lord, the same as I, but comes up with the opposite message. And yes, indeed, Jeremiah, for example, said that Hananiah, you're hearing a false god. You weren't in God's assembly hearing this. However, when it came to the command to go forth and destroy the enemy, I think that that ideology of God being the patron God fighting for God's people was so strong that that question would hardly have arisen. However, it developed in the prophetic period again, and you can see it especially emphatically in the fact that this God of Israel not only commands that the enemy be destroyed, but that God's own people be destroyed by war as punishment. And that shows how that moral principle begins to become more evident than the nationalistic principle for understanding God. Yeah, Jim.
I don't have the details exact. It seems to me in Kings that it says that was Elijah instigated the fellow to exterminate the whole house of
Ahab.
At Jezreel, and yeah. Hosea says that God was displeased with that bloodshed.
Yep. That's a criticism of an earlier act which was done under prophetic auspices. There is a questioning of whether God, that's a very good instance, Hosea chapter 1, the blood of Jezreel is laid on the dynasty of Jeroboam as a blameworthy act, even though it had been instigated by a prophet. So there is ambiguity here.
Who was a hero.
Well, a great hero, Elijah, none less than Elijah. Excellent. Now, we need to move on, so we see that there's no king in Israel. So we've dispelled that picture, tribal period, good, kingship, bad. So are kings good? Are kings, finally, God's solution as those who bring in shalom? How does kingship arise in Israel? Historical situation again. Philistines attack. The militia cannot handle the attack. They had up until now. Ark is lost to the Philistines. Elders come up to Samuel, who was the last judge, and said, we need a king. Samuel responds by going to God. God, they want a king. They're rejecting me. God said, they're not rejecting you, Samuel. They're rejecting me from being their king. Give them a king, but warn them what the ways of the king will be. They'll take a tenth of your lands, the best of your crops, your daughters to be as perfumers, your sons to be as chariot drivers. Bottom line, quote, and you will become his slaves. No, the people say, but give us a king, and here we should read the verse, 1 Samuel 8, verse 20. No, but we will have a king over us, that we also may be like all the nations, and that our king may govern us and go out before us and fight our battles. That's why Israel wants a king. What's the effect of kingship on war? Well, there are a lot of effects. The Philistines were defeated, and Israel's autonomy as a nation was preserved through war.
Economy gets you organized around war.
Okay, those are
Solomon.
There we go down through the lists. Remember, David conducted a census, and a plague broke out in the land. Why? I mean, what's wrong with the census? Well, what Jim said, the census was a breaking up of the old tribal sacred divisions, establishing new divisions rationally on the basis of taxation concerns. 12 groupings, each capable of producing enough revenue for the war machine for 1 month of the year. That's why the plague broke out. God didn't like what David was doing. The temple was built. David planned it, Solomon executed it. What is a temple? A temple is a chapel of the king. It's the king getting control of the religious cult. You can see that in Solomon, he built it, and there were no prophets in the land. Solomon took control of religion in the land. Psalm 110 calls the Davidite, you are my priest forever. Not my king forever, my priest forever. Kingship is collapsed, or I should say priesthood and cult is collapsed into kingship. Psalm 145 refers to the king. Your throne, O God, is forever. That's pretty heavy stuff. The king is God. And then finally, the king is promised that he will reign forever. Psalm 89, I will establish your descendants forever, God says. I will build your throne for all generations. All other Hebrews had to live with a fairly sterile moral condition. If they disobeyed God, they'd be punished, and even killed. The Davidite here in the royal theology is exempted from this. Why? The land then lapses into a new structure, shows social stratification. King can't do wrong. King presides over the priests. The priests over the people, the nobility over the peasants over the slaves. And, well, 1 Kings 8 said it, God said, and you will be slaves. So, with kingship, we have a reimposition of this kind of stratified society. And you can see in the prophets clearly what that brings in. What do the prophets say about the society under kings? You can see it in their attacks on the people. What happens? What's the quality of life under kings? Oppression. Okay, more.
Injustice.
What else?
Inequality.
Chaos.
Chaos.
Okay, I mean, we need shorthand right now because of the time. You were beginning, some of you consciously, some less consciously, to repaint the picture we had begun with of chaos. Of chaos. Of a collapse of the shalom that we saw fostered by that earlier ideal, born of slaves released from this kind of structure. So with the reimposition of people buying property rather than keeping it in trust as God's gift to each family, as the result of people buying up the houses of others and turning them through indebtedness into slaves, as the result of people competing and hating one another, we had chaos growing. And what is one of the manifestations of chaos? War.